Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week, Film Spotting plops itself down on a park bench and begins a conversation with a 6-foot-tall invisible rabbit listing the top 5 all-time films about loneliness.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by The Nadas, and our classic heist marathon kicks off with 1951's The Lavender Hill Mob.
We'll also have another installment of Maddie's Movie Minute. Can't wait for that. But first, 700 years in the future. The Earth has been overrun by trash. No, it's not Soylent Green. It's Wall-E.
700 years into the future, mankind will leave our planet, leaving Earth's cleanup in the hands of one incredible machine. His name is Wall-E. After all these years, he's developed one little glitch.
Wow.
A personality. He's extremely curious. And just a little bit lonely. But all that is about to change.
Maddie, you may recall you recently incurred the wrath of many Film Spotting listeners for daring to criticize Pixar. I believe the term you used was insidious. In your defense, though, you were really just riffing on the Disney-owned animation studio's incredibly effective marketing tactics. You don't have a beef with Pixar's films, and in fact, you've actually professed to me that Toy Story, the movie that put Pixar on the map, is one of your all-time favorite movies. Wall-E writer-director Andrew Stanton was one of the writers on Toy Story, and he also had a hand in A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, and Monsters, Inc. before getting his solo shot as a director on Finding Nemo. Despite the huge role he has played in the studio's mammoth success, I think it's fair to say that it's Brad Bird who gets most of the acclaim. The Incredibles and Ratatouille and The Iron Giant before them aren't just kids' movies made for mass consumption, they're art. One might go so far, and many have, as to call him an auteur, a filmmaker whose imprint is clearly identifiable in all of his work. Meanwhile, it's Stanton who is regularly helping Pixar turn out the blockbusters, and it's his name on Pixar's biggest hit to date, which was, of course, Finding Nemo. So does Stanton deserve more respect? And should Wall-E, a quirky little sci-fi tale about a lonely robot finding love, give it to him?
Yes. Yes, okay. Yes, 1,000 times yes. I think Stanton has leapfrogged Brad Bird if we are comparing this film against Ratatouille. I think Ratatouille sort of suffered from an overabundance of ideas, if that's possible. It's as though it had introduced all these sort of interesting threads, and it never really followed up exactingly on one of them. Wall-E, for me, is just something short of, if not nothing short of magnificent. It has absolutely nothing to do with the visual flair, actually. I actually think the visuals in Kung Fu Panda are more arresting. But it's the storytelling that Stanton employs here. So intricate. So economic. We sit here every week, Adam, and bellow and moan for filmmakers to chop off the first 10 minutes of their film so that we're not spoon-fed exposition like we're some invalid in a home. What I love about this film refuses to dumb down for its audience. It opens, and as an audience, we're disoriented. We're in desolate Soylent Green land. And like the genius of Soylent Green, which opened with a quick slide montage to get you up to speed, Wall-E launches you into the world and piece by piece lets you deduce what exactly happened to the human race, how we got here to this world full of trash. And then it introduces you to Wall-E, a character straight out of Chaplin's The Little Tramp, with the same charisma as Johnny Five from Short Circuit. And of course, he warms your heart with these sort of golden retriever puppy dog eyes full of wanderlust. And that's nothing new. I mean, Disney has been excelling at anthropomorphizing animals and robots since Thumper. But it's the adventure. It's the adventure that Wall-E undertakes here that makes this film so, so brilliant. I was an Argonaut to Wall-E's Jason here. I was hanging on every single step this little robot took. The magnificent, brilliant attention to detail here, and I have to say, some of the most ambitious and mature storytelling I've been treated to in years.
Yeah, this film really is brilliant. And you make a great point how we do sit here and bellow about these films that spoon-feed us information. And this one opens up a lot of really interesting questions, but then gets right down to the story.
Exactly.
And we don't need all those answers. We can trust that it's 700 years in the future. For whatever reason, he's the last robot left, and we go with the story. And I really do appreciate Andrew Stanton and everyone at Pixar for that. And I don't want to oversell this movie or over-intellectualize it because it's great fun, but this is an interesting science fiction movie.
Yeah.
That's maybe what I didn't expect going in. The Earth is overrun by trash. You have this corporation, the By and Large Corporation, great name, that launches everyone into space, and they're supposed to return when the trash problem is fixed, and they end up staying there for 700 years in this kind of Logan's Run-esque pleasure dome. And this sci-fi marathon that we did a few weeks ago over the past several weeks on the show really prepared us incredibly well for this movie.
This is
it's
a
unbelievable.
Perfect tie-in. Yeah.
I mean, really, the references are all over this movie, and maybe we'll get to some of them, but this pleasure dome they live in, and they have machines taking over everything to the point where they don't even know how to stand anymore. The humans don't know how to get up out of their Barca lounger, and they do everything they want from that seat, watching TV, talking on the phone, eating, drinking, whatever. And I do completely accept the idea, and I've seen Stanton make this remark, that he is much more interested in giving us a cute love story than social commentary, but it's there nevertheless.
Yes.
I mean, there are lots of interesting ideas behind this film, just like the interesting ideas we saw explored in our 70s sci-fi marathon, and it's great fun to watch and to think about, but at the same time, never losing sight of that great love story between Eve, this robot he meets, and between Wally. It's great fun, but like I said, at the same time, I couldn't believe how caught up into it I was in thinking about all these interesting science fiction questions. I didn't expect that from the movie.
No, it really is brilliant. And yeah, you're right. He's in love with another robot.
Mm-hmm.
And as my ex-girlfriends can relate, I maintain a really unhealthy relationship with my 1982 Bang & Olufsen Beogram 2400. I know exactly what
That's a record player.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I know exactly what this little guy is feeling. And you're right. He gives us this great love story set against this backdrop, but he doesn't linger. He doesn't preach. He doesn't hammer home all these ideas. And that's probably the one flaw I had with this film is when he finally does get up into space
mm-hmm.
onto the ship. We're introduced to humans through this brilliant sort of use of flashbacks while we're on Earth, and we actually see they're real humans. There's Fred Willard is the president of By and Large, and I think he might be the president of America
right.
as well.
Uh-huh.
I think that's genius. And then once we finally meet the humans in space, they're computer generated and they're big beached whales.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why they had to do that. But that world wasn't as effective for me. It didn't quite resonate as well
no.
for me. But luckily, while we're on the ship, he spends so much time with the robots on that
mm-hmm.
ship. And every single one, I just love the details of this movie. Every single one of those robots has a through line.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a purpose in this film. I just think that's amazing. And of course, I mean, if you've got 4 years to make a film, you might as well do it right. And I think he does it. And I think we also have to give our props to Ben Burtt and his team of sound designers. The sound makes this film.
Yeah.
Wally doesn't talk. He basically says his name. And also
Eva.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And kudos also for avoiding the nauseating trend of shoehorning one of those overproduced Randy Newman, Tim Rice
yeah.
pop songs into the narrative. And instead, what they do is they include these classic show tunes beautifully, because what they evoke over this desolate landscape, my God, they should have done this years ago. It's amazing the effect that has on people.
Yeah, using Hello Dolly is kind
exactly.
of this beta tape that he's found, this remnant of the old world. It really is fun to watch. And you're right about the world on board this ship, the Axiom, which is where the humanity has escaped
it's
to.
It's a little cartoony. For
it
the
is.
First time, I'm like, okay, I am in sort of cartoon world.
Sure,
here.
It's a little awe-inspiring still, though, I think, just in terms of the holograms and the effects and the complexity of it and all the speed and motion. I really did enjoy that, but I do think if you wanted to nitpick, that the human characters aren't as interesting as
yes.
they could be. And admittedly, it's a movie about robots, but you get to the captain on board the Axiom, who I believe is voiced by Jeff Garlin. And in terms of what he decides to do from a narrative standpoint, and again, I know I'm nitpicking here, but I'm just saying this question the movie raises about, do these people want to return to Earth? Should they return to Earth? It doesn't delve into some of those things as much as it could have, but the fact that I'm asking those questions just shows you how much this film has going for it, how much I was invested in it. And while at the same time it's doing that, it's funny and it's touching and entertaining and challenging. In terms of the storytelling, you mentioned it. there is 40 minutes or so at the beginning where we don't get any dialogue mm-hmm. except hearing Hello Dolly and maybe a few noises that Wally makes. And then on board the ship, all we get is the captain and a few other people.
But during that first 40 minutes, we are in the cabin with Charlie Chaplin, the little tramp.
Yeah.
Using that tin plate as a hat, it really sort of is transcendent, the mm-hmm. power that they're able to evoke with that character.
Yeah, and it is a lot like a silent movie. You're absolutely right. And it gives the sense. This is what I really love. And I saw this comment from one of the designers behind this film, maybe it was Andrew Stanton, that they wanted to give the sense that it was truly shot. Not so much real in terms of its look, but real as in someone was standing next to these characters mm-hmm. with a camera. And I think that's absolutely there, especially in some of the space scenes and during this great dance sequence that we get between Wally and Eve. It's really there and it's fun to watch. But then you do add in the photorealism of it. And you find out at the end of the movie that they went out and got Roger Deakins from No Country for Old Men and In the Valley of Ayla and The Assassination of Jesse James, which were all really well-shot films. You find out that they got him to be a technical advisor on this film. The dialogue for this movie, as we touched on, must take up about 10 pages of the script, mm-hmm. and that's it. It relies on brilliant animation and, I think, brilliant and sometimes complex sight gags and little details. It really forces us to pay attention to every shot.
Well, that's what I love about it. The humor here is situational and it's physical. It's not topical. There's been this trend lately of sort of invoking Saturday Night Live type humor, and I think it takes away from the timelessness of these films. I think the film I first recognized it was actually Aladdin, where Iago the Parrot, voiced by Gilbert Gottfried, says not at mm-hmm. one point. Well, look, that is not going to stand the test of time, that reference. That's why these films don't quite belong in the same category as Snow White. I would put this film right up there.
That is a fantastic point. I think this movie really is timeless. You're absolutely right. And I do think as well, I do want to touch on another aspect of the visuals, because you said that you were more into the story than the look of it. I probably lean a little bit towards the look of it, because I've never seen an animated film with frames that have so much going on. There are three or four layers of depth to many shots, especially at the beginning to those opening scenes in this city. And I do think that Stanton has really raised the bar here for animation. I do think he has maybe outdone Brad Bird. And that doesn't get into maybe some of the things Brad Bird likes to explore thematically. But visually, I do think this film takes it up a notch. It's really amazing to watch. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention a couple of the sci-fi references.
Yes.
We have to just point these out real quick. And the great thing about the sci-fi references is they're there and they're funny to the people who will get them, but they're not too clever.
Exactly.
It's not a case where they're all just patting themselves on the back for including them. But there's, of course, 2001, Alien. The voice of Sigourney Weaver is in this film in a really great way. Soylent Green, we said it already, but with the trash, it's wonderful. Logan's Run, of course. The Omega Man. We talk about the opening of The Omega Man with Charlton Heston driving through the streets of L.A. and it's empty except for him. That's the first 40
yep.
minutes of this film. Wally the robot going about his job, doing his thing, going through the streets with this lonely, empty environment, the desolation of it. It's really fantastic. And then, of course, Star Wars. You can't overlook a few Star Wars references. And I actually think that there's a shot in this movie, Maddie, that they took. I don't want to get into this too much and be too much of a Star Wars geek, but there's one shot where the bad guy, the bad robot, is hurting Wally, and they cut to a reaction shot to the other computer, and it's the same shot. It's the same sequence, I think, shot by shot, as the Emperor and Darth Vader watching him hurt Luke at the end of Return of the Jedi. I'm telling you, it's there.
Yeah, and there's so much for a film lover here. There's so much for adults here. In fact, you and I actually talked about this a little bit after the film. I'm wondering if kids aren't going to have stretches here where they might be tempted to be
a little
bored.
Yeah, I think it's possible. I can't wait to take my kids this weekend, and we'll see. We'll put it to the test. I do think there's enough humor, enough physical humor, that they will really enjoy it. But we will have to see. I do look forward to taking them. And now we go, Maddie, quickly from the mainstream multiplex to the art house for another edition of Maddie's Movie Minute.
Maddie's Movie Minute. He takes us to the show for 60 seconds or so and gets right to the point of what we need to know.
And now,
here's Maddie.
Let's all get cozy in Maddie's Movie Minute official yurt for a little Mongolian barbecue as we take in Mongol, the latest epic chronicling the adventures of a young Genghis Khan. If you like grandiose adventures in the style of Braveheart or The Charge of the Light Brigade, this is the film for you. If you don't like grandiose adventures in the style of Braveheart or The Charge of the Light Brigade, this ain't the film for you. Actually, unlike Braveheart, where William Wallace is captured only once, young Genghis is captured about five or six times, and we spend the better part of this film watching him escape from a slew of enemies that seem to multiply with every year he ages. All in all, it's a fun film, lots of sweeping, majestic camera work, lots of battles, though the climactic battle scene was probably the film's least effective, with just a dash of Macbeth thrown in for good measure. But don't worry, there's nothing heavy-handed about Mongol. This is a film about guys being guys, obsessing about horses, swords, honor, and revenge. Errol Flynn would be proud.
Maddie's Movie Minute. Maddie's Movie Minute. Quick reviews to help you choose it. Maddie's Movie Minute.
All right, Maddie, thank you for that. As always, Mongol is out now in limited release, and WALL-E is in theaters everywhere. If you see either film and agree or disagree with our takes, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. Of course, you can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-CINNA. That's 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Why puny bugmen not like part of Incredible Hulk or Hulk Smash? That best part, puny bugmen make Hulk angry. Listener feedback is next. Stay with us.
Moonlight scatters on the water. Glimmer like the stone I bought her. I'm so puzzled by the pieces of plans I have for us when she says,
I'm here for you,
here for you,
to make the good stand out,
clear to you,
clear to you,
in a phony tinsel.
Hey guys, this is Courtney from San Francisco, California. I was just listening to Film Spotting number 215, and I usually don't pay that much attention to the music, but I really liked Birdie, so I just bought a couple of their albums, and I want to thank you guys for turning me on to them. I don't expect to find music from my movie podcast, but thank you, and keep up the good work. I love you guys' show. Thanks. Bye.
Hello, Adam and Maddie. This is Micah Wood from Orem, Utah, originally from the Netherlands. In The Fugitive, it's Jeroen Krabbe who plays the doctor. Can't really remember how you pronounced it, but he's a pretty big actor in the Netherlands, and he's done some good work outside of the Netherlands as well. And I just wanted to let you know how to pronounce it correctly. Thanks for the show. It's great, and we look forward to listening more.
Hey, Maddie and Adam. This is Jeff in Atlanta. Thanks for the great review of The Incredible Hulk. I haven't seen it yet. I have to say, the movie that you described that you wanted to see sounds to me exactly like the movie that was Hulk, Ang Lee's movie, which I really did enjoy, and I feel like it hasn't gotten the credit it was due.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. Some great voicemails there. I wanted to feature that one from Courtney because we do get some comments from time to time on the music we play on the show. We know it's not for everyone, but for the most part, it's all tunes we really like. And it's nice to hear that Courtney really enjoyed Birdie on last week's show. And then Micah, I believe, was the name there. Originally from the Netherlands, and Maddie, the irony of me absolutely butchering that actor's name from The Fugitive is that, of course, Kempenaar is from the Netherlands. I should know better about my brethren, but I have to say, really, when you heard that name the way she pronounced it, I wasn't anywhere close. It was a disaster.
Are you going to try it again?
No. No, I'm absolutely not. There's no way I could say that. My lips actually will not make those sounds. And then finally, Jeff in Atlanta, he brings up an interesting point about the Hulk that we're actually going to see followed through here in the mailbag as we get into listener feedback. So we'll get to that here in a moment. But first, we did want to share our poll question, starting with our results from last week. And we've actually had the same question up on filmspotting.net for a couple weeks here because we're letting listeners decide which Steve McQueen movie should be part of our classic heist movie marathon that is starting here in the show. In the next segment, actually, we wanted to know which movie we should see, The Getaway from 1972, Sam Peckinpah, Ally McGraw and McQueen, or The Thomas Crown Affair with Steve McQueen and my gal, Faye Dunaway. I think Norman Jewison directed it. How did it come out, Maddie? What are we watching?
We are going to be watching a little Ally McGraw and Steve McQueen in The Getaway. Close, very close, Adam. 53% to 47% over the original Thomas Crown Affair.
That's right. And of course, some listeners suggesting we should just watch both movies, Maddie. Why aren't we doing that?
Yeah, right.
It's hard enough to fit in the six we've picked. I'm not sure about that extra one, though. I do really want to check out the original Thomas Crown Affair. We'll see if we fit it in. This week's poll question, it's a pretty obvious one, tying in with our review of WALL-E. We want to know, will you be rushing out to see WALL-E?
Yes, I have to take the kids. Yes, the kids have to take me. Maybe. I'm not really an animation guy, gal. Nope. I'm renting Short Circuit.
Obviously, we encourage you to run out and check it out, but let us know what you think. Go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard in the poll question. And that brings us to the mailbag, listener feedback. A lot of reactions on our review of The Incredible Hulk here on the show a few weeks ago. And I can't remember if we mentioned this or not on last week's show, but of course we heard from a copious number of listeners who pointed out how we did say Bruce Bixby on the show and we said David Banner. Of course, it's Bill, not Bruce Bixby, and Bruce, not David Banner.
Well, I love the fact that we actually sat here for 5 minutes and debated this, and that wasn't even the outtake.
No, I didn't include it in the outtake of the podcast, even though I should have, because we were debating it. I just couldn't remember. We'd just come from the movie where they called him Bruce Banner, which makes more sense from a comic book standpoint, Peter Parker and Clark Kent, et cetera, et cetera. But I remember the TV series more than the movie even. And it's David Banner in the TV series, Bruce David Banner. And then you said Bruce Bixby, not Bill. And I was like, okay, sure, there's Bruce. We'll fit it in. Anyway, we do apologize for
and
the
another
error.
Intern loses a job.
Exactly. Let's start with this email here from Jonathan Metz in Boulder, Colorado.
I listened to your review before seeing The Incredible Hulk, and maybe you lowered my expectations, but I really enjoyed this film. Ed Norton's performance nails the frustration inherent within the Hulk. Most of the time, he's just a regular guy with no special abilities, just this anger management problem. As the Hulk, he can get out of any situation but has no control over himself. You complained about losing the human connection whenever Hulk was on the screen, but that's actually part of the story and characterization. Banner considers the Hulk to be a separate personality. Seeing the two of them gradually converge towards the end of the movie is immensely satisfying. The biggest problem with this film, and all superhero films, is the struggle to develop an interesting and formidable villain. Maybe it's because the best superheroes are already so mentally conflicted that their external battles seem mindless and unnecessary in comparison. Only the X-Men's Magneto is complex enough to make the big fight scenes mean more than a show of muscles.
I wonder if you agree with that, Maddie. Do you think the problem with some of these superhero movies is that the villain isn't up to the challenge of the hero? We certainly lamented that about Iron Man a little bit.
Well, what about the I call it the original Batman, but look at the late 80s Batman. Mm-hmm. You've got Jack Nicholson chewing the scenery in that film. I certainly felt that he was Michael Keaton's equal.
Yeah, I did too. And maybe that is something that's lacking about the Hulk. I do agree with that sentiment from Jonathan, and he brings up a good point about the fact that the characterization of the Hulk, we get it that the character is a split in personality, and of course you lose Bruce Banner when he transforms into the Hulk. I think what we were saying, though, during our review is that's an inherent limitation of this particular
yes.
comic book superhero, is that once we lose that character we've invested something in, the movie does falter a little bit.
Right,
for
exactly.
Us.
Well, he becomes a video game character. We don't quite, I mean, obviously his motivation is to smash, but I'm not as invested in this sort of larger than life pixelated force. I wanted something just a little bit more that I could relate to.
Yeah, I agree with that. Let's go to this one from Jobert Atienza in San Leandro, California. I totally dug the first act with Banner hiding out in South America, basically living like a recovering drug addict trying to start over. We love that too. And I love the nods to the Bill Bixby show I saw on reruns as a kid in the 90s. I will have to disagree with you on the last act of the movie. I thought it wrapped things up nicely and gave what most people were looking for, the Hulk and Abomination thrashing each other. There's something that Maddie said, something to the effect of the audience being lost when the real fighting began. I don't know what audience he saw it with. I heard a few claps and cheers when Hulk was laying the smack down on the bad guys. I even noticed I was gripping the armrest of my seat during the fight. Sure, the second act was kind of weak and Liv Tyler was pretty but bland, but I think this movie has a little bit of everything for everyone, and I can't wait to see if or when they release an extended cut on DVD.
I'm sorry, that last 20 minutes for me was like watching someone play Mortal Kombat. You've got the big reptile guy, you know, he's going to hit him over the head, and mm-hmm. how's the Hulk's going to react? There's actually no stakes involved for me
You're
whatsoever.
Right. No, I agree. I didn't have any suspense there either, and that's the one area where I would definitely disagree with Jobert, is that I didn't have that gripping the armrest reaction to the end of this film, and I have had it with other superhero movies. I didn't have it here.
But he's absolutely right about the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
There's something out of the Bourne Identity there.
Yeah, you're right. That's great stuff there. We do agree about that. And he brings up the idea of the extended cut on DVD. A lot of people writing in saying we wanted the full version of the film, the one that Marvel didn't cut down. And it turns out that the director, Louis Leterrier, is going to have an additional 70 minutes of footage on the DVD release, the Blu-ray edition. And while that's great, great. My impression is that it's not 70 minutes shoved back into the film where it belongs, but just sort of scene after scene that was cut out. Some are good, some are bad. He's even said some are good, some are bad. I want to see that first cut of the movie that was like 2 hours and 15 minutes long, not the 90-minute one. I don't know if we'll ever get that.
All right, well, let's move on to another one here. This is from the Hulk in Parts Unknown. Again, people, you need to send in your location.
Please.
Why puny bug men not like part of Incredible Hulk where Hulk smash? That best part, puny bug men make Hulk angry. Without Hulk smash, Hulk movie just about wangy Bruce Banner, existential angst. Unless weakling Banner turn into Hulk, movie have no raison d'etre. Who want to see 2 hours of puny Bruce Banner trying to not get angry? No one, that who. Hulk smash provide dramatic tension. Why film spotting aid on Hulk? Hulk go eat pie now. Sincerely, Hulk.
Sincerely.
I like his use of the adverb at the end.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. We do appreciate that email. I wish we knew where the Hulk was. And I also wish that we did enjoy all the Hulk smashing. We just didn't get into it as much as obviously the Hulk did there or some of our listeners. I guess I like the whiny Bruce Banner existential angst. That's just the way I roll. David Glover of the Inappropriate Behavior podcast writes in, just a quick point. All the stuff that you complained that was missing from this Hulk movie is, to my mind anyway, exactly the same stuff Ang Lee put into his. Unfortunately, there are so many people out there who just didn't get what Ang Lee was doing that this time around they said, no, we want to make the big smash crash blockbuster. There was even apparently a long sequence, probably before he gets to the States, which is why it jumped so badly, where he decided to kill himself and went to Antarctica to die. But it was decided that would be too dark for the film they wanted to make. My point is they cut all this good, intelligent stuff in favor of the Michael Bay stuff for one reason, and one reason alone. You didn't go see and reward the first one for doing it properly.
Well, Vanessa Naboa from Champaign, Illinois chimes in. First of all, when I watched the new version of the movie, all I could think about was Ang Lee's version. Oh my gosh, how I hated that movie. I didn't go to the Ebert Fest here in Champaign because I couldn't bear having to watch that again. You said that the second time around it isn't that bad, but seriously, I don't know if I could even handle it again. That's why I like this version so much more. Yes, it has a lot of action and CGI moments, but come on, guys. It's a movie based on a comic book. And yes, we are getting spoiled with the Batman prequels, with all this dark soul searching. I think Ed Norton does an awesome job, unlike Banner, but mostly because of the way the Hulk is portrayed in the movie. Banner's Hulk I thought to be whiny and wimpy, ironically, while Norton shows true anguish while turning into the Hulk. His troubled personality is much more believable. I really enjoyed the action and even the random lizard thing in the end. The CGI wasn't bad, in my opinion. I was actually a little scared of the Hulk this time around. I understand we all want to see how superheroes struggle with their strengths, but I think for a first in the series, the Incredible Hulk pulled it off, giving us hints of pain and frustration, but in the end, being a true badass. Isn't that the point of being a Hulk? So here we go, Adam. We've got point counter point
yes.
on Ang Lee's Hulk. I have only seen snippets of Ang Lee's Hulk. You sort of the aficionado
sure.
giving it a pass, having seen it at Ebert Fest
yes,
a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago now. So where do you weigh in here?
Well, it's interesting because, again, we go back to our voicemail we heard at the start of this segment, Jeff in Atlanta saying, isn't this what we were asking for? Didn't we already get it with the Ang Lee version? And I guess I disagree because that movie is so out there. The pleasures of that film are the art house aspects of it, the things that Ang Lee is trying to do visually, and it still has a lot of bad things about it in terms of the writing and some of the acting and whatnot and the special effects to a large extent. And it actually falls prey to the same problem that this Hulk does, and by the end, it's just a bunch of mindless action that we don't care about. What I actually wanted from the Hulk and what I thought it was giving me was like the X-Men films, like the Bourne Identity. You mentioned that, right? There is a Bourne Identity aspect to the beginning of this film. A superhero movie, a spy movie, whatever, that nevertheless feels grounded really in reality, which is what the X-Men managed to do. There's nothing very real about that Ang Lee movie, but I thought what this movie was going for and almost pulled off was that very real, modern-feeling, relevant superhero movie, comic book movie, and it just fell short of it for me in the end. So it isn't quite what Ang Lee was going for, but maybe on the same path, if that makes sense?
Market zero, next frame.
Bullshit, Walter. Market eight, dude.
Smokey, this is not Nam. This is bowling. There are rules.
Hey, Walter, come on. It's just, hey, man, it's Smokey. So his toe slipped over a little, you know? It's just a game, man.
This is a league game. This determines who enters the next round robin. Am I wrong?
Yeah, but I wasn't.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, but I wasn't over.
Of course, a clip there from The Big Lebowski with John Goodman, and it ties into our recent top five from last week's show. We did our top five actor-director duos, our top five actor-director tandems, and we got a lot of emails like this one from Robin, who couldn't believe we left off Mr. Goodman.
I enjoyed your top five list for the actor-director pairings, and I agree that with so many great pairs out there, it's tough to come up with a definitive top five. That said, I think you left off a pair that, at least to me, is one of the most effective and enjoyable director-actor relationships out there, John Goodman and the Coen brothers. Every Coen film that he's in is made so much richer by his performance, so much so that you can't imagine anybody else in that role. Of course, we know that the Coen brothers actually write roles.
Yes, they do.
With Goodman in mind. Raising Arizona, Barton Fink, Oh Brother, and of course The Big Lebowski. His acting, and in particular his timing, is so perfect that I have to assume the parts were written for him. Because it's a tough list, I'll grant you to a stay of execution. Thanks for the podcast, and keep it up.
What do you say, Mr. Ballgame? I say for shame to you.
Yeah, I know. You know, even
had a supporting list.
One of the greatest travesties of the Academy Awards is that John Goodman did not even get nominated for Walter Sochik. I think he should win every year for that performance. But the fact of the matter is, I don't love Barton Fink. I think he's good in that film, and I do like him in Raising Arizona, but for me, it's really Big Lebowski that he really delivers. So that's why he didn't quite make my list.
That's an interesting point there. I can see where you were going, though. I love him in Barton Fink, and I love him in Raising Arizona, so maybe he should have been on my list instead. We really did get a lot of great responses. A lot of people claiming that we forgot people.
Right.
We didn't forget anyone. They just didn't make our top five, and we will get to that on next week's show, hopefully, as we get into some more of your great responses. People bringing up David Fincher and Brad Pitt and John Woo and Chow Yun-fat, all sorts of great combinations. And we have to mention, at least quickly, Joseph Kaufman. Poor Joseph in Louisville, Kentucky, emailed today, Maddie, and said, "You didn't even give me any credit for last week's top five." It is true. At the end of May, he was the one who wrote in with a top five suggestion to do an actor-director duo. We failed to give him credit on the show or on the site. Joseph, we love you. Thank you for the suggestion. We do appreciate all the top five suggestions we get, and we do appreciate all the great feedback we get. Please email any other comments or suggestions to feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, we will share some more of your thoughts on those actor-director duos, and I'm sure we'll have plenty of thoughts on Wall-E.
All right, time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater, and we get wild and wacky, UK style. No, Adam, it's not Benny Hill.
Damn.
I know, my grandfather's disappointed too. It's the start of our classic heist marathon. Stay with us.
There are ghosts inside these halls. They're dragging chains across the floor and vanishing through walls. I've been one of them lately. You can't see me sitting here. I can't see the TV screen.
I'm Ellen Page.
And I'm Diablo Cody.
We are the actor and writer of the film Juno, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Do you think she's in love with you?
I don't know.
Well, I guarantee you she's not, and she never will be.
Max.
I save Latin. What did you ever do?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. I'm Maddie. He's Adam. It's time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a DVD of your choice. Now, last week we massacred the scene you just heard between Bill Murray and Jason Schwartzman from Wes Anderson's Rushmore.
Yes, and Eric Bentrot from Cleveland, Ohio wrote in. I thought he summed it up well, the tie-in here. He says, "This week it is from Rushmore, the great director-actor combination of Anderson-Schwartzman. Or is it Anderson-Murray? Or is it Anderson-Wilson? It could be all three, couldn't it, Matt?"
Yeah, of that trifecta, where do you lean, Mr. Kempinar?
I guess I go Anderson-Murray. Everybody loves those guys together, right?
Me too. All right, well, why don't you reach into that old film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner?
And the winner is Jim Owen from Seattle.
We are so huge in Seattle.
We are. We're big in Seattle. Congratulations, Jim. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
The other day, when I heard Mr. Fabian tell Miss Channing that her understudy was going to have a baby, and they'd have to replace her.
And you want to be Margaret's new understudy?
I don't let myself think about it.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, though I have two more quick notes about Rushmore, the third most entered Massacre Theater of all time.
Very beloved.
Yes, it is now just behind The Iron Giant and Tootsie in the list of Massacre Theater scenes. And also, I Save Latin. What did you ever do? That line from last week apparently gave it away to 90% of our listeners.
Well, I love the people that write in and say, you should have left that last line off. Why would we leave that last line off? I mean, the reason that we include these great scenes, we're not trying to trick anybody.
For the most part, we're not.
Exactly.
You're right, and that's the best line to say. That's the very reason we picked the scene. Well, let's find out why we picked this scene. It does tie in with our top five this week movies about loneliness, and I really do think, Maddie, this week, unfortunately, we're spoon-feeding our listeners yet again. It's pretty much a slam dunk, but let's go ahead and give a shot here. I'm going to give you the action as you start it off. And action.
It's so beautiful.
Hey, you're beautiful.
Who should we vote for? They're more your crowd than mine. I don't have a crowd.
Let's vote for ourselves.
No.
Why not?
Oh, please don't vote for ourselves.
Come on. To the devil with false modesty.
The devil.
And scene. Apparently, we just fell into a production of The Crucible. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback at filmspotting.net. You have until Wednesday, July 2nd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries, and I'm guessing there's going to be quite a few this week and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
The van will stop in front of him at 4:30. A minute later, the guard will appear around this corner and you, Pendlebury, will detain him for at least half a minute. Ask him for a light, ask him the way, ask him anything, but keep him there. We must have those 30 seconds.
Edgar.
I beg your pardon?
Isn't one supposed to say that when one's being briefed on my rare visits to the kinema?
The word is Roger.
Oh, Roger. I'm silly of him.
To continue. As soon as we've captured them there, Mr. Wood and Mr. Pendlebury will proceed straight to the warehouse.
A bit risky, that, isn't it? Making Mr. Pendlebury go there after the guard's seen him.
That's a whiskey mistake.
Adam, the Lavender Hill Mob, a 1951 offering from the famed Ealing Studios of London, is a gang that couldn't shoot straight, assembled for an inside job by the doughty Alec Guinness. The plan is to smuggle stolen gold bullion out of England in the form of Eiffel Tower paperweights. The job, of course, is bungled, and hilarity, supposedly, ensues. Now, Adam, when we solicited suggestions for our classic heist marathon, we received everything from The Muppet Movie to Reservoir Dogs. So is it safe to say that the tone of this film is closer to The Muppet Movie than Reservoir Dogs? And if so, does this qualify as a classic heist film?
Yeah, I think it definitely qualifies as a classic heist movie. It definitely belongs in this marathon. I'm glad we started with it. I did really enjoy this film, and the reason why is because it precisely fits nicely in between a comedy like The Muppet Movie and a movie like Reservoir Dogs. Maybe not so much Tarantino with all the violence and gore and whatnot, but in terms of what we think of as a modern heist movie, an action movie, I think this movie gives you a little bit of both. And I don't think there are many films that can pull it off. We saw last week Get Smart not be able to pull off being an action spy movie and also about a bungling guy and be funny at the same time. And I think this one really does work distinctly as a comedy. It's not uproariously funny. I don't think you're laughing out loud throughout the film constantly. At least I wasn't. But it is very funny, and it also works distinctly as a heist movie. It does take itself seriously enough to work as a caper movie. I think some of the chase scenes we get, the police car chase at the end, is great fun. The Eiffel Tower sequence, which has shades of the scene, of course, from Vertigo. The Third Man. I thought about the carousel scene in The Third Man. Reminded me a lot of what we get here. And I think the robbery itself is actually quite suspenseful. So this film really worked for me.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. You're right. The gang is so inept, but it's matched by the ineptness of Scotland Yard. Mm-hmm. If I was one of the Queen's subject, I'd be really, really worried
about
that.
I thought of that, too. Because their reputation is that, you know, they're so good.
And, of course, you have to suspend your, you know, disbelief, of course, to assume that, you know, to allow for an amount of absurdity absurdity, but right. It's sort of ridiculous that they can't quite put two and two together. And I think if there's one element that's missing for me, it's that side of the law. We never really do see their perspective. I would have liked, you know, if not a Sherlock Holmes and maybe an Inspector Clouseau or somebody kind of on their trail, yeah. Someone I could sort of invest in from that side. But this movie had me in the first couple minutes when Audrey Hepburn waltzes across this, never to return, actually.
Right. She was supposed to have a bigger part.
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't end up with it.
It's terrific. It's just sort of a fun little ditty of a film. And one of the things that I really liked about it was, yes, it's very predictable, but at the same time, I love how messy it is mm-hmm. at the film. It really leaves questions unanswered.
Yes, it does.
And actually leaves fates unanswered at the same time. So even though this is sort of inventing the genre that we're going to know to become, it's not creating all those cliches that we're going to get to know. I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I did too. And, you know, you talk about the Muppet movie and Reservoir Dogs and some of these other movies. The one I really thought of, which I think actually you can essentially call a heist movie, is Double Indemnity. This movie is in some ways, I think, kind of a convivial take on Double Indemnity, a boring average bank employee trying to pull off something big. Yes, it's about the money, just like it was for Walter in Double Indemnity, but he wants that life, as he says in one of the great lines from the film, the life he is unaccustomed to, mm-hmm. he's never had before. But I think the reason he's smiling at the end of the film, the reason Alec Guinness, his Mr. Holland, is smiling at the end is because he did pull it off, essentially. He did get to have great fun in the process. You think about the scene on the Eiffel Tower where they're racing to get down, the whole thing is about to fall apart, and they can't stop themselves from laughing. They realize that there is great humor in what they're doing and great fun. They get to break out of their boring middle-aged man routine.
Yes.
And I think that really is what's fun about it. They get to experience the life they always wanted, even if it was fleeting, even if it was just for a bit.
Yeah, exactly. They can live to the extreme in that moment because actually chasing after those girls with those Eiffel Towers, why? Why would you actually do that? Why are you spending any energy doing that?
Well, evidence, Maddie, come on.
Yeah,
go
sure,
with it.
Right. But I love the framing and just the overall filmmaking of this film mm-hmm. is superb. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful to look at. And you touched on Alec Guinness's performance is superb. I mean, he's absolutely charming, and I believe it. He is just grinning from ear to ear in every single scene, and you're getting at it. It is these guys who are let out of the asylum for a day, just having fun.
Yeah, and he was, we should note, nominated for Best Actor in a Leading Role for this film, and it actually did win the Academy Award for Best Writing Story and Screenplay. So this movie did have some acclaim at the time it came out. But you talk about Alec Guinness. For me, the classic Guinness moment in this film is when he first throws out the idea that they could pull off this caper without actually suggesting they do it. He's met the Holloway character. They're at his factory. He sees what he does where he melts these Eiffel Towers down and whatnot. And Holloway says something about how it's a good thing they're honest. And Guinness says, yeah, good thing, or something like that.
Oh, the way he plays
right,
in that
exactly.
scene, yeah.
And the realization is dawning on Holloway of what Mr. Holland is suggesting, that they could actually try and do this. And Guinness turns his back to let it sink in for Holloway. And then he turns around again in excitement and just smiles at Holloway. He can't contain his excitement. He's so giddy about it. I love that moment. At the same time, though, he is this stuffy bank employee who has always been in this shell. So you get that juxtaposition of this giddy kind of kid, or as you put it, the person being let out of the asylum.
Sort of the cocoon effect, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you mix that with the guy who has been in that shell for so long and really is kind of a good, proper Englishman in many ways. That's where the humor comes from. That's what I like, is that the humor isn't really this kind of Keystone Cops type
right.
of humor. It really is more coming out of these characters and their relationship. They have a great friendship, I think, those two characters. So I did really have fun with this movie, and I do want to at least read this one quick email here, Maddie. Some more listener feedback tying in with our top five again from last week, actor-director duos. Tom in Cincinnati said, gentlemen, you managed to overlook one of the finest film directors of all time, collaborating with one of my favorite actors and the star of your first entry in the heist film marathon. I give you a top five British film list: Bridge on the River Kwai, Dr. Zhivago, Great Expectations, Lawrence of Arabia, and Oliver Twist. Might you say, in the words of Sir Alec Guinness's Colonel Nicholson, what have I done? From the classic finale mm-hmm. of the David Lean-directed Bridge on the River Kwai. So some love for David Lean and Alec Guinness. We heard a few listeners chime in with that last week. And after seeing this, I know that I need to see a lot more Alec Guinness films beyond Star Wars, of course, as well as some David Lean films. So it sounds like we both agree we got off to a good start with this marathon.
Yeah, we're off and rolling. This is a lot of fun.
Well, and next week we get to have a little bit of Stanley Kubrick fun. We will discuss his 1955 film, The Killing. For the complete classic heist lineup, please visit the marathons page at filmspotting.net.
All right, time for one last quick break. When we return, we finish filling out our online dating applications and gorging on 2 pints of Rocky Road.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
While giving you our top 5 movies about loneliness. Stay with us.
Is this the part where you say no? Just so I'll go away. Is this the part where you say so? So I'll fold and you fade.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. A movie, Maddie, that we both wanted to see, we hoped to talk about on the show, and didn't get to it. Maybe we'll be able to find some time now. It is My Blueberry Nights from Wong Kar-wai. Nora Jones making her acting debut, I believe.
Exactly. And actually another one coming out this week that both you and I wanted to check out, City of Man, of course, the follow-up to City of God, a film well-loved here on this show.
Sure. And Fernando Meirelles, the director, I don't believe he directed this one, but he did produce it. So I do want to check that one out as well. And one we also skipped but read a really fun interview with Forrest Whitaker from Time Out Magazine, where he mentions that he basically thinks his own movie Vantage Point is a big pile of crap, and critics and audiences agreed. It is out now, and it's got audio commentary by the director.
Wow.
I always love that. Wow. So Vantage Point's out. I'm sure we are going to check
it out. I'm sure
it
begins something with like, okay, oh, jeez. Oh.
What was I thinking?
What? And then it just trails off in the silence.
Maybe so. And also out, we go into the Wayback file here. Heathers is out. This is a new version of it, but apparently the only new feature is a documentary called Return to Westerberg High. Everything else is the same, but it is a two-disc 20-year reunion edition. Heathers, of course, the movie that got some love recently from our listeners during our recent Top 5 dialogue exchanges. I remember a very good script there for Heathers. And then finally, Baby, It's You. This is actually a John Sayles film, a very early John Sayles film that I've always wanted to check out, have never seen. It's out now on DVD.
You have not seen one of John Sayles' films?
There's a couple.
Wow.
There are a couple.
You're blowing my mind this week, Kimpy.
This week, our contest, again, our top five movies to teach an alien about Earth. It is the top five we're going to try to fit in on next week's show. We really need your help here because this one is a tough one for me to wrap my head around. This is the scenario. Netflix offers every movie ever made on the internet. NASA gets a signal from an extraterrestrial life form. The alien has signed up for Netflix and wants five movies to learn about life on Earth. You have been picked to choose these five movies. Please share them over at filmgaming.spout.com. Again, this is helping to support the show and helping come up with our content for next week. We need some good ideas for this top five. One lucky winner will get some funky Spout American Apparel swag, chosen, of course, by the fine people over at Spout from all the entries, and we'll share that winning entry on Film Spotting 217 next week. You have until Wednesday, July 2nd to enter.
All right, time now. We want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. Thank you to this week. Thank you, thank you, thank you to Matthew in Ealing, London.
Wonderful.
A gold donor. Thank you so much, Matthew. Keith in Round Lake, Illinois, a Silver Club donor.
Yeah, and I wonder, this just now hit me. This is how dense I am. Matthew in Ealing, London, the Lavender Hill Mob, they steal gold bullion. And he's a Gold Club donor. Do you think he was actually going for that?
Are we abetting something here?
Maybe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Maybe he stole something, or maybe he's just that clever, and he gave us a Gold Club donation just for that
reason.
We'll
take it. We'll take laundry donations.
Yeah.
No problem. John from Parts Unknown also donated this past week. Paul in Alexandria, West Dunbartonshire. In the UK.
We got some great names.
Absolutely mangled that. I'm so sorry, Paul. Jonathan in Mortdale, New South Wales, Australia. We are taking over that continent city by city. Paul from London as well, donating this week. And Joshua in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. Brian in beautiful Portland, Oregon. Elliot in Watford, Hertfordshire, UK. Jakob. I'm going to go with Jakob just because I've
seen
so much Bergman. In Bergen, Hordaland, Norway, though it upsets my grandmother Skoog every time we get a donation from Norway, we will take it. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Mark in beautiful Oak Park, Illinois, and Mike in the capital city of Ottawa, Canada.
Yes, Ottawa, where I was last week for 4 or 5 days, and I had a chance actually to hang out with one Mike in Ottawa, who very generously donated here to the show. I also got a chance to hang out with Casey and Pat. I just love Casey, Pat, and Mike. They sound like my Irish brothers or something, and we did actually spend most of our time in Ottawa that night at Irish pubs. Mike donating there, I think, because I generously bought dinner for everyone, but then they decided to give me free beer the rest of the night. And Maddie, I have to say,
that's a trade-off film spotting will make every day of the week.
We will.
And twice on Sunday.
I did something I haven't done in about 5 or 6 years, which is actually Casey and I closed down the pub we were at, got kicked out about 2:30 in the morning, was definitely feeling it the next day.
He's all grows up.
I know. Mike and Pat, actually, they were a little more responsible, took off a little earlier in the night. But this is the type of degenerate listener we have out there, Maddie, in Ottawa. They took me out for a hooker's beaver tail. Yeah. Can you say that on public radio?
I don't think George Carlin got fined for saying that.
It's actually a fine Ottawa delicacy. It's like a fried cinnamon treat. Have you ever heard of an elephant ear?
Yes.
Okay. Well, of course you have. You're from Minnesota. They love fried food up there. And it's like that.
It says the guy from Iowa. Our state fair is the best state fair. Where do you eat elephant's ears?
You know what's ironic, too, is I had actually never heard of an elephant ear until they said it. But I had a hooker's beaver tail, fantastic stuff in Byward Market. And then I really have to share this, too, Maddie, because how funny is it that on the show where I mentioned I was going to Ottawa, you threw out Jim Carrey, like, I'm going to meet Jim Carrey, this Canadian. And I said something about Bryan Adams, and you said, is he from Ottawa? And I said, no, I doubt it. I'm just an ugly American, and you made fun of me and whatever. They told me at our dinner that it turns out Jim Carrey.
He's from Toronto. I was thinking of Tom Green.
Yeah, you're right, Tom Green. Jim Carrey has nothing to do with Ottawa, but Bryan Adams actually went to high school for a year there. So I was right.
Yeah, you're so much better than me.
I know I am. But again, I want to say thank you to Casey and Pat and Mike, and especially to Casey, who did spend the rest of the evening out with me buying me drinks. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, remember that for every $10 you donate, your name is entered into the legendary film spotting hat. And at the end of the month, we pick a name and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours, a really successful spinoff of the show that we enjoy doing. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab at the top of the page. Also wanted to mention, you know, in this economy right now, money is pretty tight. There is another way to support the show, and that's to contact your local public radio station. Let them know you want to hear Film Spotting on your public radio. Send them an email, give them a call. You can direct them to prx.org, which is the Public Radio Exchange, or, you know, just give them our contact information. And also, we've got Film Spotting swag available on the Film Spotting website. Lots of fun stuff to do on filmspotting.net.
Is this the part where you break free? Because you broke me. Because you were born. Is this the part where we trade keys? Because you've saved me. What's in store?
It's the old American double standard. You know, say one thing, do something different. And, of course, the country is founded on the double standard. That's our history. We were founded on a very basic double standard. This country was founded by slave owners who wanted to be free. Am I right? A group of slave owners who wanted to be free. So they killed a lot of white English people in order to continue owning their black African people so they could wipe out the rest of the red Indian people and move west and steal the rest of the land from the brown Mexican people, giving them a place to take off and drop their nuclear weapons on the yellow Japanese people.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. Of course, a clip there from the great George Carlin, who recently just passed away. And Maddie, we've had some tributes here on the show recently, Sidney Pollack and Harvey Korman. And at least one listener wrote in and said, hey, it always happens in threes, so who's going to be next? Well, we got it here actually in fours. We had Stan Winston, the great special effects visual master, gave us some great stuff in Alien and Terminator, and just a really brilliant guy who I think a lot of movie fans like you and me probably take for granted on some of those films, but really those films would be nothing without him. And then George Carlin here at the age of 71 just passing away really is unfortunate to see.
Oh, it's so sad. I mean, I think we forget that George Carlin inspired the comics that inspired me. So my generation is, you know, a generation removed. But, you know, he sort of came to the fore here again towards the end of his career. I love his stuff in The Aristocrats, a great documentary about stand-up comedy in that. And as a tribute, National Public Radio has allowed me now to utter the 7 words you cannot say on radio.
How are you going to pull this off, Maddie?
Unfortunately, I can't do that. But if you ever get a chance, I have a couple of his vinyl records, and they're great. The Hippy Dippy Weatherman, his older stuff.
That was the early quainter George Carlin.
Yeah, that stuff is a little bit quainter, and then he gets a little bit more blue. But I actually prefer him to Lenny Bruce. Of course, Lenny Bruce broke open so many doors. But I actually think Carlin has a little bit more finesse, a little bit more structure to his work. So.
Yeah, well, I do think Carlin is brilliant. I loved watching his specials on HBO over the years, and it's sad to see him go. So we just wanted to pay a little bit of tribute both to Carlin, of course, and Stan Winston, a great special effects guy. And with that, we do want to get into our top five movies about loneliness. The film world is a little lonelier without these greats, and here we are talking about our movies about loneliness, really tying in with WALL-E. We've got this robot kicking around Earth by himself for 700 years. So, Maddie, what's your number five?
Well, my number five, you know, first of all, I just want to say there's such a broad spectrum to choose from here this week. And I think I came up with a pretty eclectic grab bag. And it was a lot of fun because I thought I'd end up with a lot of movies in sort of the Harvey vein. And confession, I really don't like Harvey. I don't like that movie. So it started at my number one. And I was looking for movies to give me an excuse to keep it off my list. Thankfully, I found several movies to bump it off.
Wonderful.
And if you're looking for a movie that's the complete opposite of Harvey, you probably can't go wrong with my number five, Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Wow.
Diane Keaton stars as this sheltered school teacher with his abrasive, abusive father, the great Richard Kiley. And of course, to escape from her mundane existence, nightly she goes to the bar looking to sleep with a new man each night, gets into doing hard drugs. And a lot of people actually read the film as a condemnation or a eulogy to the end of the women's lib movement. I think its appeal is actually broader than that. And it really resonates with me because it speaks to the power of addiction, any addiction. And once those tendrils sort of wrap around you, you're at its mercy. And what you're trying to do is just to salve a wound, to look for anything to fulfill you. And I think, of course, that's the great meaning behind our loneliness list here.
Mm-hmm.
Great performances from Richard Gere, and especially Tuesday Weld as a sister. Be forewarned, the final scenes are brutally, brutally harrowing. It's not released on DVD, but
really?
If you get a chance, take a look.
Yeah, I've seen it on TV, on HBO or something late at night, and I remember being traumatized by seeing Diane Keaton, Annie Hall, in all these terrible situations, including there's nudity in this film, and I think of Diane Keaton as kind of this pinnacle of purity. It really threw me for a loop, but that is a good choice there, Maddie. My number five is also a little obscure, I think, along the same vein there as Looking for Mr. Goodbar, and it is the movie The Collector. It's a movie that ties in, actually, with our discussion of Get Smart last week in Terrence Stamp. We mentioned Billy Budd was his first film. This is Terrence Stamp's first Hollywood film. It's a 1965 movie by William Wyler. I think this narration says it all, actually, about why it's on my list. I suppose it was the loneliness and being far away from anything else that made me decide to buy the house. And after I did, I told myself I'd never go through with the plan, even though I'd made all the preparations and knew where she was every minute of the day. He's an unassuming bank clerk, a lot like the Lavender Hill Mob's Alec Guinness character, and he wins a fortune, like in a lottery. And that allows him to focus on his obsession, which is this art student, this London art student played by Samantha Eggar. And so he's just this lonely butterfly collector who ends up collecting her just like he would a butterfly and keeps her locked up in the cellar of his farmhouse that he just bought. It's a really solid psychological thriller, and Terrence Stamp is just great because you loathe him for what he's doing, but at the same time you see how careful and respectful he is of this thing that he just collected and how much he loves it.
Kneel down before Zod and the power of Terrence Stamp.
There you have it.
All right, my number four is probably the most obvious pick on my list. What do you do with all the time in the world on your hands? Why not become an expert on bird disease? I'm going with The Birdman of Alcatraz. As a kid, Escape from Alcatraz with Clint Eastwood and Birdman were two of my favorites. Burt Lancaster is stellar in the lead role. I think he actually was nominated for Academy Award. But it's Frankenheimer's camera here. He puts you in that cell, and you really do experience the tedium. Some would say to the film's detriment. I think it's really, really effective. And I got to admit, I love Telly Savalas in this film as well.
Sure.
And of course, Carl Malden is the warden.
Another inspired choice there, Maddie. For me, I'm going a little bit art house Adam here, but I've got a pairing here of two Wong Kar-wai films, In the Mood for Love and Chungking Express. And In the Mood for Love was on my list of movies set in the 60s a while back. And it was also a big omission. We talked about it last week from our recent Best Dressed top five list. But In the Mood for Love is just a luscious movie with Maggie Cheung and Tony Leung. Their neighbors, their spouses are having affairs with each other. They develop this friendship that never quite blossoms into the love relationship that it should. And then you've got Chungking Express with these two stories that come together. All these characters in Hong Kong, they're hurt by love, they're searching for love, all of them are lonely, and they're looking for that connection. Despite the fact that they're living in Hong Kong with millions and millions of people, it's really about how you can be isolated and alone even when you're surrounded by all those people. And it's a good contrast in some ways to my number five film, The Collector, where he said he was lonely and he was far away from everyone. Here, this is a case where you've got all these people in this city stuck together and yet they're alone. Great films.
Great choices. Well, all I can say is, Ma, sooner or later, there comes a point in a man's life when he's got to face some facts. And one fact I got to face is that whatever it is that women like, I ain't got it. Look, I chased after enough girls in my life. I went to enough dances. I got hurt enough. I don't want to get hurt no more. Unfortunately, I probably said that to myself far too often. That's the great monologue written by Paddy Chayefsky, of course, Marty. Ernest Borgnine is brilliant here in the titular role as this blue-collar Bronx butcher who ain't got what the girls want. And actually, in doing research for this list, I realized it was based on Chayefsky's teleplay, which starred Rod Steiger as the original Marty.
Really? And now, of course, thinking of Quiz Show, I want to insert in the audio of John Turturro saying, Marty, come on, how can I lose on Marty? One of the favorite lines I have from that film, actually, Quiz Show. Good pick there, Maddie. My number three is The Conversation. Francis Ford Coppola film from 1974. And actually, this is going to help set up my next two picks. Robert Kolker, a film theorist, a film writer, he wrote a book actually called A Cinema of Loneliness, Penn, Kubrick, Coppola, Scorsese, Altman. In 1980, that book came out. And here you have Gene Hackman as Harry Call. He's in his apartment, you know, by himself. He plays his saxophone that he won't play for anyone else to see. And all he has is his work as the surveillance expert, and we see then that unravel around him and him with it. And he's constantly paying attention to other people and their relationships, but he's completely solitary until he finally does get involved, and that's really his downfall. But it has one of the all-time great closing shots in cinema that says this whole list. If you want to sum up the loneliness list in a nutshell, just look at the last shot of The Conversation.
It just missed my list, and I kind of have a little controversial take on that film. I love Gene Hackman. I love his performance in that film, and I love his performance in Scarecrow, another film that came out around that time. But the fact of the matter is, Gene Hackman is larger than life. He has such a dynamic presence. John Cazale is in that film. Now imagine the conversation with John Cazale. Everybody would know him, of course, as Fredo.
Yeah.
Imagine him as the lead character. And well, I think it adds another dimension.
I could see that, but I actually like the fact that you have this larger-than-life Hackman who's been reduced to this kind of shell of a man.
Yeah, okay. All right. I can't quite go there. I can't quite go there. I can't get past this. This is Gene Hackman. He's so big, he could take any of these people.
Yeah, maybe so.
All right. Well, my number two, I think it's really fitting that this film takes place in Tokyo because it reminds me of the works of the legendary Japanese filmmaker Ozu, much less deliberately paced than his works, but Lost in Translation offers the same scarcity of dialogue, and it's just a really nice portrait of the human condition. You've got these two lost souls in Scarlett Johansson and Bill Murray. They find themselves in a port of call, and I think they find something in each other, and I don't think they know what it is, but it's that something that allows them to embrace their life just a little bit more fully, and I think it's directed by the best director in the Coppola family working today.
Maybe working today, yes, that is a fair comment to make. And that's a good choice. It's a movie I like, and that's a movie Lost in Translation I kind of would have assumed that you weren't into at all.
Why is that?
I don't know. Just because I think it's almost fashionable now among people to rip on Lost in Translation, that maybe I thought you would be among them, but of course, the great iconoclast that you are.
It's too hip for me,
maybe.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's basically what I'm saying. I mean, look at the rest of your list. You've been referencing Harvey, for crying out loud.
Well, just because you haven't seen an American-made film before 1950.
So? Guilty as charged. Well, let's go to an American-made film from the 1970s. Another one, and hear a scene.
Loneliness has followed me my whole life, everywhere. Bars and cars, sidewalks, stores, everywhere. There's no escape. I'm God's lonely man.
Well, if I said that that closing shot of The Conversation summed up this top five in a nutshell, this character sums up the entire top five. That is, of course, Travis Bickle from Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. It's a lot like Chungking Express, where you have a character surrounded by people in New York, and yet he's totally isolated and totally frustrated, and then we see that violence that pours out of him because of that frustration and loneliness. One of the all-time great films.
you know, I get goosebumps actually just talking about that film. It is my number one. I think this film gets overlooked when discussing great Vietnam War movies. He is a veteran of the war. Mm-hmm. He's so affected. He can't sleep. He can't relate to the reality around him. Now he's in these urban jungles that he has to navigate. His moral compass is completely his own. So much so that, of course, he resorts to brutal violence in the name of justice. Now think of that as an allegory of what we were doing in Vietnam and possibly what we're doing now. I know it's become cliched for video nerds like us to champion this film, but it is remarkable viewing, if unsettling to watch.
Yeah, great stuff there, and I'm glad to see it there at your number one. It was almost my number one, but in the end, I was won over by the majesty of one Giulietta Messina.
Oh, here comes Art House Adam.
There you go. I can't help it. My number one pick here is La Strada, and it's a tie with Knights of Cabiria, two Fellini films, and actually two films from a trilogy commonly known as his Loneliness Trilogy. The other film, Il Bidone, I haven't seen. But really, I screwed up big time last week by not at least mentioning one of the greatest all-time actor-director duos.
Yeah, I didn't want to say anything, but geez.
I can't believe you didn't jump in. But Fellini and his wife, Giulietta Messina, they're so amazing, and in both these films, you know, it's funny, Fellini actually said about his movies at one point that the subject of loneliness and the observation of the isolated person has always interested me. Even as a child, I couldn't help but notice who didn't fit in for one reason or another, myself included. In life and for my films, I've always been interested in the out of step. And so that's what you get in these films. In La Strada, one of the great road movies, Anthony Quinn and Messina, she's sold into slavery, basically, to work for this carnival, you know, this circus strongman. You see these two disparate souls really come together here and make a connection. And the Knights of Cabiria, one of my all-time favorite movies, with Messina as a prostitute who thinks she's finally found love. And, of course, it's just a ruse. She really hasn't found it at all. And it's really kind of the breaking off point for Fellini, where he went from that really hardcore realism, the neorealism, to the magical kind of realism with these films. But two of my favorite films of all time, just edging out Taxi Driver. It was tough. They basically could be 1A, B, and C, but there you go.
Now, Fellini, he mm-hmm. was the second director under Michael Bay, a lot of his projects.
Yes. Nicely done, Mainstream Matty.
Right. Well, my honorable mention, I do have a couple. I wanted to go with Lars and the Real Girl, show a little bit
no
of love
kidding.
For that film, The Haunting. And another film, it's not great, it's a little gimmicky, but Alone with Her, a film that came out last year with Colin Hanks. It's actually kind of a fun watch.
Well, surprise, I've got four really arty choices. I've got Solaris.
Ooh,
pick
that's
either,
a good one. Good
yeah,
one.
The Tarkovsky or the Soderbergh. Either way is good with me. I've got Into the Wild. Come on, the Sean Penn movie that we both like so much from last year. That whole film is an affirmation about how you need people.
Yeah, you're
That's
absolutely right.
About.
You're right. The message at the end that
yes.
perhaps you do need people, it's just that he's so self-assured that he doesn't need society. You're right. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, he
All
is
right.
alone.
I can go there
yeah,
with
and
you.
He comes to that
there.
Realization. So I had to include it here. Also, a movie from one of our marathons, Pedro Almodovar's Talk to Her. I think very much a movie about loneliness. And then I got to throw in another great Italian filmmaker, Antonioni, Le Eclisse, La Notte, La Ventura, all about alienation and loneliness. My favorite subjects, really. I just like to sit at home thinking about isolation and alienation. That's just the way I am, Maddie.
I weep for your children. Well, those are our top five movies about loneliness. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. Don't keep us lonely.
No, opening wide this weekend, Wanted, a movie, Maddie, you didn't get to, a movie that we thought looked horrible, with my guy James McAvoy.
It's actually getting a lot of good
buzz. I know,
buzz.
And Angelina Jolie, it seems to be getting a decent slate of reviews. I'm kind of shocked so far. And then WALL-E, which we reviewed in the opening segment and say, rush out to see.
I am taking your kids to go see it.
Yeah, Uncle Maddie, they're fine with that. On next week's show, we'll review Hancock, the latest summer blockbuster from Will Smith. Jason Bateman is also in that movie. And we're going to share, if we can pull it off, our top five movies to teach an alien about Earth.
Thanks as always to Candace for her invaluable production assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. And special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia over at Chicago Public Radio, and to the Nadas and Authentic Records for this week's music. Learn more at AuthenticRecordsOnline.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
We are rolling.
Oh, we're hot?
Yes.
All right. All right. Check and see if the red light's on. Got to make sure I'm hot.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Radio voice time. Welcome back. What? Oh, God.
Which way are you looking? Which way are you usually looking? At that one?
Well, I look at both of them.
Okay.
This is a panoramic.
Okay, dude.
Oh, Jesus. Team of monkeys.
Yeah. So, yeah, just do that part quickly again. And
all right, Jack, we're going to just run that. We're going to run that Hulk segment one more time. We're going to go hot, everybody.
Didn't really end it definitively.
No, that's all right. Just fade in. Well, Jack, what we're going to do is we're just going to fade in that clip from Lebowski at that point.
No one's listening.
All right.
It's like the actor's nightmare.
He said he can do it. Yeah, just roll it over. We'll just fade it. And if he can take out Mike 2 on that, I think we should be fine.
Let me just say this one line. Maybe I can use it. I'll say.
All right, he's going to take it again. We're going to go hot, okay?
You bastard.